Just take a moment. Just take a few minutes. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Now we're all here, and I don't look at your little names on the screen. Me and Lucky are here by myself. Nala.
I want to do a Purva Paksha on verse 4.
Okay.
And it's a two-part objection. The first part is that about the
Pratyabhijna.
The fact that your experience of your constant presence before and after all your experiences somehow means that you can't destroy yourself. And there was a book one time called The Black Swan, and he said, he said, Europeans always thought all swans were white until Australia was discovered, and they had black swans there. Okay, so that's just the first part of the objection, that I don't quite get how that constant presence means that it can't ever go away. And the second part is where he says, nothing else can destroy me, for I am not in parts. That makes total sense, but then I don't see the reason for the first part. If nothing can destroy me because I'm not in parts, why do we even need to say that first part?
I understand. Okay. Kind of my underlying the Purvapaksha, underlying it, is an understanding of the pramanas, how we know what we know. And so you can't just say, well, it could be like this, when the like this doesn't fall within the scope of means of knowledge. Okay? So, in other words, say, not that you're doing this, but I just want to set this foundation up. Say if you say something, well, I think reality is like such and such. Well, then I might say, well, what do you base that on? Well, I just think that. But what pramanas do you have? What means of knowledge do you have to substantiate that opinion, right? And so I think in the West, we're not so used to confining our opinions to what we can actually prove or what can actually withstand inquiry, what can withstand the pramanas. Okay, so that's an important thing. So now here we're looking at, in reference to me destroying myself, so as the Atma, that somehow I could just disintegrate or come to an end just by my nature. What is going to, from just now, remember, we're just doing from the standpoint of the self. We can now, and then we'll do it from the standpoint of the other. Then we'll do it from the standpoint of the ashraya. So it's not like you can say, well, once we do this standpoint, then this standpoint isn't necessary. There's truth in that. There's some truth in that. I'll get to that later. But we're looking at, in Vedanta, you're circling every single thing, looking at some truth from different standpoints. Even though the one in this case could solve that problem, still we're looking from different standpoints just to just kind of seal the deal, so to speak. So, but here, in terms of myself and my own self-experience, it's impossible for me to have any type of experience that would touch me in any way. That's not possible. Why isn't it possible? Because the pratyabhijna is there, in the sense that no matter what the experience is, and by the word experience, we're going to include absolutely everything that is objectifiable. There's no limits on it. Doesn't matter what it is. If it's objectifiable, then what I discover in my experience is that it can't touch me in any way. And then we say, well, why can't it touch me anyway? Well, because it's not the subject, it's the object. And in the subject-object relationship, there's a differentiation there. And that's also something that we experience. We don't experience the subject being aware of itself as an object. Even with the Atma, the self is not aware of the self as an object. It is its own self, and that's why we say the word self-evidence, swatthasiddha. It is its own experience that doesn't involve any type of knower known or any type of duality. It's just consciousness itself, which is its own experience. Okay, so now that experience is free of parts, right? Because anything that has parts is going to be objectifiable. And so from its own standpoint, there's nothing to bring about change. And from the standpoint of every single experience that you have, because it's objectifiable, it's not going to touch me. And that is my experience. There is no experience I can bring in that doesn't fit that. So you might say, well, you know, like the black swan or something, I should be able, maybe there is some experience out there. But what would be the criteria for that, that would make it separated from objectifiable experience? Because if it's not objectifiable experience, it has to be the self. Do you see that it has to be the self? Because if it's not the self, it has to, because if it's a second thing, it has to be within objectifiable experience. Even knower known is both the knower and the known are objectifiable. Like the seer and the seen, they're both objectifiable. So I have to say I'm the self of the seer, I'm the self of the seen. So how can, if there's the pratyabhijna there, what I'm recognizing is that there is no experience that is me and there is no experience that can touch me, both things. And I myself have no parts because I'm not objectifiable. Does that make sense or is it not
enough?
That
all makes sense except that they're saying that the self cannot destroy the self.
How can it destroy the self?
I don't know. It just didn't seem like they were proving it by that, by saying that. It didn't seem to me they were proving it by saying that I always survive all experience unchanged.
Well, the thing is, though, is like, say, okay, this silly example, baby, but say, you know, I used to be a really happy person. now I'm really sad, right? So now the happy person has been destroyed. I used to be young, a young person, but now I'm old. So the experiences that I've had, you know, have changed me. The young person is not the old person. The happy person is not the sad person. And so I'm actually being changed all of the time. So I can even then go on to say the living person will not be the dead person. You know, the waking person is not the dreaming person. In the dream state, I've destroyed the waking person. So if the self is destructible, we should be experiencing its destructibility. Like say, as I'm growing old, I'm destroying myself. Slowly but surely, right? The body is decaying and slowly dying, and eventually it will be dead. So I'm experiencing this destruction of myself. That's what we think. You know, we say it in a different way. I'm growing old and decrepit, and I will die. Mm-hmm. My mind, instead of be staying sharp and alert, is becoming duller and duller and duller. Okay, so my mind is slowly, slowly and decrepit. It's destroying itself. So I am destroying myself. Okay, because what am I? That's my experience. I'm destroying myself. That means that I have taken myself to be the one who is going through this process of destruction because of that, you know, superimposition. So how are we going to defeat that? Well, the Pratyabhijna says that the person who was alert is the person who is now dull. Right. So the self of the alert person is the self of the dull person. The self of the young person is the self of the old person. Mm-hmm. The self of the waker is the self of the dreamer. So that is my experience.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, but if that's fine, these experiences of decay and of change and of destruction belong to something which is objectifiable, not to me. And so I have no experience where the self is being destroyed. I only have an experience of the self being present to all the experiences of destruction that are taking place. You see what I mean? So that Pratyabhijna frees me from that identification. If I recognize in all of the spirit experience of this decay or whatever, or of dying or of mental decay or Alzheimer's or whatever is going on, if I recognize that the one who was like this is now the one who is like that, right? Then I'm the same person. That there's something about that experience where I remain the same as the experience changes. Now say you say it differently. This person, you know, the person who was like this, right, used to be like this, is no more. Destroyed. Now there's this person. There's no relationship between this person and this person. That means they're not the same person. There's no Pratyabhijna there. Because this one has died. This one has destroyed itself. So we experience, within duality, we experience decay, you know, which is a different type of destruction, with the upadi, the decay of the upadi, whether it be the mind or the sense organs, whatever. And we experience the death. So that there's the destruction of the decay, and there's the destruction of death, right? And so in the Pratyabhijna, if the Pratyabhijna was not there, for every modification that took place, that would be somebody else then. That's
yeah.
The idea.
Yeah.
So now, can I go on to the Anyataha? Okay. So with the Anyataha, now I'm looking at somebody who is other, not me, could attack me and kill me and destroy me. And that is true. Like any person, any animal, any bear, you know, any mosquito, you know, could attack me and kill me as long as I am the body, you know. Anybody could attack my mind and upset me so much that I have an emotional breakdown. That's all possible. Because within duality, the attacking other can actually destroy many different parts of me and even kill me, you know. But how can anything within duality, right, attack something, the self, that is non-objectifiable and therefore not able to be attacked. If the self is objectifiable, then it's subject to attack. But if I'm not objectifiable, in fact, I'm your very self. There's no possibility of attacking me. And so I have no parts. I'm not something that's objectifiable in the world that you can come after. Whereas if I'm this body, mind, sense organs, there's a lot of things you can come after, right? And destroy in this way or another. I'm available. I am embodied. The word umsha means parts, and it also means the whole body. The other meaning, parts, I have no parts. You can't chop off my arm, or you can't take my sense organs, you can't do anything with it. They're not available for you.
Yeah, no, I don't have any problem with that argument. I just didn't understand why you needed any other arguments.
Yeah, because somebody will ask, not putting two and two together in that way. And then with the third one is the ashraya. You know, you can say, well, you know, I'm not objectifiable and nobody can attack me, but my consciousness, which cannot be objectified, nevertheless is dependent upon the existence of this body. This body is what supports and contains consciousness. And so then if you were to kill this body, even though the self is non-objectifiable, the body, the self, will be killed when you kill what supports it and contains it. So that's the other one. Makes sense. That's good.
So the identity is with that, if not the self, well, all that is going to deteriorate, and all that is going to go away. The identity is with the self, with the Atma, Brahman, that doesn't deteriorate.
Beautiful thing is whether you have knowledge or ignorance, say you have self-knowledge or you have no self-knowledge, the self is the self, right? It doesn't really matter whether you know it or not. What is and is not objectifiable, your own being, it never changes. So you're simply, when you gain knowledge, you're simply recognizing that reality, the fact of it, because it's there to be recognized. You know, it's, say yourself is experientially not unknown because it's self-evident. So the self-experience of me is already completely present. You don't need knowledge for your self-experience as the self-evident nature of conscious being to be present as you, the me. I call it the me experience. When you think me, whether you have knowledge or not, that me is still very much intact. You know, and all of these teaching methodologies are just pointing to you. And then you go, oh, yeah, well, yeah, that's me, and I've always been that way, because you see it clearly. So the self experientially is there always with or without knowledge. But without knowledge, your own me-ness, your own presence, is by the mind, taken to belong to the mind, taken to belong to the body. And that's this ashraya thing. So if as an ajnani I take me to be dependent on this body, then when the body dies, which we know it will by our experience, then I will die, right? If I take myself to be this body, mind, sense organ, somebody else could also kill me or get rid of me, you know? Or when I become senile and I'm becoming decrepit, I find myself losing myself, you know? So all of these experiences I have, but what I have to recognize is that all of these experiences that are taking place, there is one constant, which is me. But that me has never been differentiated. It has to be differentiated. And when it's differentiated, you know it's you because it's who you are and always have been. You're just taking all of these dresses off that you had identified as being you. And you realize, oh, take this dress off. Well, I'm still here. Take this dress off. I'm still here. Nothing's happened. You know, when we do meditation and you're kind of pulling back from your experiences and just kind of turning, they'll let the mind kind of turning inward, pulling away from objectifiable experiences, you never think as you're going through that process, I'm not here anymore. You know? Right? What happens is all the other experiences, you know, the mind is turning away from or pulling back from, but you're still here. And there's never going to be a time when it's not you. It's just that you're not wearing these dresses that the mind had taken to be responsible for your being, so to speak, or to be you. Like, say you take yourself to be the mind, then sometimes you, this me, I am a happy person, I'm a sad person, I'm an angry person, an agitated person, a stupid person, a smart person, you know, tired person, whatever. Because I'm only seeing myself through the lens of these upadis, the lens of these emotions. I never think about me, that pratyabhijna. I was here when I was sad, and now this, I'm here when I'm happy, and I was here when I was agitated, so I can't be any of these states because they come and go and I don't. We don't really tend to think that way until the Vedanta kind of, the Upanishad kind of holds up a mirror and you go, whoa, well, that is such a simple concept. There's this very powerful little piece of logic that's the Anvaya Vyatireka. Right? The Anvaya goes, it shows the relationship between two things, when this is, that is. And then there's the negative way of saying it, when this is not, that is not. Right? If you can say both the positive and the negative, then those two are very tightly woven together. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. But so what we can always apply that, the in terms similar to the pratyabhijna. If I can say, when this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. Then I'm tied into that, whatever it is. But what if I can say, when this is, that is, and when this is not, that still is? So like, what if I say, when this emotion is, I am. When this emotion is not, I am not. No. When this emotion is, I am. When the emotion is not, I still am. When this perception is, I am. When this perception is not, I still am. So what you can do with that, because it's a no, that logic is very powerful. So you can look at all of your experiences and differentiate yourself from everything that leaves. If the experience leaves, it's not you. It doesn't matter what it is. It's mithya. If it can leave, if you can be without the experience, it's not you. I don't know how to refute that.
So when I have a doubt, this doubt keeps occurring to me. You know, in the Trayavastha Sakshi Prakriya. So I have a problem with deep sleep, which a lot of people do. Because, yeah, I can say, yeah, who is it that's so cool? One problem, I mean, most of us probably experience being under anesthetic, you know, mm-hmm. or fainting. And I mean, it was like no time had passed between like out and back. And so there was, and it could have been like, say, with an anesthetic, you know, I don't know how long that lasts, depends on the procedure, I guess. But so, I don't know. I mean, I can't, to me, like to say, well, who is it that said you were out? It doesn't quite work. Because I can't even say I was out. You know what I mean?
It's a really uncanny experience.
Yeah.
But it doesn't negate anything. For those who have been under anesthetic, you know, it's a weird. you do the countdown like they make you like 199, 98. Then say by 98, you're gone. But you're not gone. You're opening your eyes. Mm. It's over.
What? I'm sorry, what?
Okay, they start, they tell you to count down.
Yeah.
199, 98. Then 98.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then you open your eyes and the surgery is over.
Right.
There is no,
no
time.
Yeah.
Because the whole mechanism, the whole body, the brain, everything is totally shut down.
Yeah.
Where I think in deep sleep, we're continually kind of surfacing. You know, there's all different levels of sleep. You're sleeping, sleeping, sleeping. You're coming up a little bit further. You're going down, coming up a little bit. You know, at least that's how it is for me. Once in a while, I get a really deep sleep where then I realize, oh, wow, I've been asleep for 3 hours. I don't have any consciousness of it. But for me, normally it's down, up, and up, and down. But, boy, with an anesthetic, it's shh, and you're down there for 8 hours, and shh, you're up. That's not our experience. We're not down to that degree. So it's an uncanny thing. Now, say that's acceptable right now. When you are in deep sleep and the mind is in its causal condition and not just coming up for air like this, kind of like breathing, like the deep sleep is kind of breathing in a way, there is no time. Because in the state of deep sleep, there is no subject-object relationship. So there is no time, right? So say if in the anesthetic you're put in severe deep sleep, the deepest, darkest sleep you can possibly imagine, then you have no, there's no like this. You're down there and that's it. And then you wake up, you know? So I understand the weirdness of the experience, but I don't think it negates anything.
I guess you know, it just makes me think about death in a way, because, you know, the scriptures tell us certain things about death. But so it makes me think, well, maybe it's just the same as boom, you know?
Nothing. Yeah, but the thing, when you are awake, then you would say that there's no such thing as consciousness. Right? But you can't, you know what, you can't even say that in that most severe experience because there is no time. You don't experience the lack of consciousness in anesthetic at all. You just experience opening your eyes. You were counting and now you're opening your eyes. Mm-hmm. So there is no experience because the antakarana, the mind, goes into unmanifest condition, unconscious condition, so there is no subject-object perception at that time. Mm-hmm. Now what if it goes deeply into that? When it's deeply into that, there's no time taking place at all. And then you're awake. Mm-hmm. So you have no experience of what's in the gap. The thing is, for us, when we're sleeping, we're not always asleep. We're different levels of sleep. Yeah. Most of us, anyway. If you go into a deep sleep, then when you wake up, you wake up. And you realize, wow, I've been asleep for 6 hours and no idea. But for most of us, we don't have that deep of a sleep.
You know, the argument produces who is it that says unslept well? And then the understanding is that the awareness is still there, illuminating, you know, the deep sleep state, and therefore you can say I slept well.
Yeah.
But you can't really say
you have to be careful. You have to be careful to not think of awareness as a knower. Right, mm-hmm. It's not a knower. It's the consciousness, you know, the knownness, which illumines the mind. Right, it's the nature of consciousness. I can call it the knownness, the self-evidentness. The mind, whatever condition it is in, because mitya is enjoying the self-evidentness that with the verse we're going to do in the morning in the Advaita Makaranda. It's enjoying that self-evident meanness. Okay. Now, when that mind is in unmanifest condition, that unmanifest condition, pure jnanam we call it, is enjoying the self-evident meanness. It's not being known. It's just itself is not enjoying any. It's not a knower. It's not awake. It's a jnanam that is being illumined by the self. So vritti ajnanam, so an ajnana vritti. Okay, now when that mind wakes up, now that's what is known. Okay, now it's the awake mind that has the subject-object relationship. Now that mind is known. That mind has a memory of the prior condition, and then that mind, now that it's now is awake, in its memory banks are this deep sleep state that it can describe.
Yeah.
You know? And so it says, oh, I slept so well, I don't remember anything. It was one of the deepest sleeps I've ever had. I didn't know one thing. Okay, but when you're in that state, there's nobody to say that.
Yeah.
Nobody to talk, because the mind is an unmanifest condition. So we say that unmanifest condition is a vritti, because it's the sattva of the mind going into unmanifest condition or causal condition. It's not in a condition to talk or say, I'm sleeping so well. But when it wakes up, then it describes that condition. So why does deep sleep gets to be problematic is because on some level we ascribe knowership. I don't know if that's your issue or not, but it is often the issue in being confused about the deep sleep state, because I feel I am a knower, and in the deep sleep I am gone because the knowership is gone. That means that you think that yourself is the mind.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a problem with deep sleep, but I have a problem with
the memory.
With what? Fainting or anesthesia, because it seems different from deep sleep, even though I know it's, and I think the scriptures they call it the same as deep sleep.
Well, they categorize it.
Yeah.
Into the deep sleep, just like they categorize daydreaming into the dream state. For the dream state, it's any states of experience, dual states of experience, where your sense organs are not operating. That can happen in the waking state as well as in the dream state, like if I'm daydreaming. So that's a dream state. The deep sleep state is where the mind is in a causal condition. And so there is no dual perception taking place at all. It's pure ajnana, pure ignorance. So anything that brings that about, like anesthesia, or fainting, or coma, is included in that. You know, as long as the coma is not, you're not in coma in a dream state, right? But if we talk about coma, being in coma, then it's as just a resolved causal condition, then those are all put into that category. Waking state is means that the experience is utilizing your sense perception.
But the thing is, along with what Tanya's saying, is it seems like it's easier to say in something like under anesthetic that there's sat there. It seems harder to say there's chit.
Why? Because if you don't.
Because unlike like in the deep sleep, like what she said, in the deep sleep state, you say. The way they often seem to prove chit is you say, I was in a deep sleep, I knew nothing, and I was in bliss. So there's a sense that even though you knew nothing, there was some consciousness of being, I slept like a baby and I was in bliss, you know. But in something like the, so there's some sense that there's some sort of chit there, even though there's no object. Chit, and you couldn't say even that you were in deep sleep until you wake up, right? It seems like
you can't say anything about the deep sleep state until you wake up, because
exactly.
The mind is in causal condition,
right?
But that's why I'm saying even though the mind is in causal condition, in my experience, you're coming out of that throughout the night. That's why you have a sense of time, because you're coming, you're surfacing.
But even if you're in a totally deep sleep.
If
you're, that's the argument, though.
No, but if you're in totally deep sleep,
mm-hmm.
then there's no time, because you're not coming. The subject-object awareness isn't coming. If the subject-object awareness isn't there, then there's no time.
But isn't it the argument is often the chit is there because you say, "I knew nothing, but I slept like a baby. I was like in bliss."
Well, it's that sukkama swapsam. I slept well.
Mm-hmm.
I slept happily.
I slept happily.
I said,
but you don't say that in something like the anesthetic situation. You can't even say that, right? Because it was just like no.
That's
no
right.
Gap at all.
There's
I
no
can
gap
say
at all.
That I had extreme longing, like nostalgia, for a 4-hour anesthetic time.
But how did you know you were in an anesthetic for 4 hours?
Because they told me afterward.
But your experience was your experience like, boom, you know. 99.
I don't know. I don't
don't know.
I could have had
there's
some
different
time.
Levels. There's anesthesia, there's different levels. There's both anesthesia. And I can put you in a very, very mild anesthesia or very, very deep. It depends how severe the surgery is.
Say you were in like a hypnosis, you can be in less or very, very deep. I didn't know that about anesthesia because I've had it a couple of times that for me, my eyes just opened and it was over. It was unbelievable.
But what mind makes the memory sort of like?
The memory is a function of the mind. It's the same.
Chit?
No, the chitta. Chitta means memory.
Okay.
The
so
chit, when we say chit, chit means consciousness.
So what is a scripture? This is a kind of a open inquiry moment here?
Sure.
Yeah, so I would be really interested to find out what the scriptures say about how to enter into this. I mean, we know there is no death in that way, because there's just a continuation. But what does the scripture say in terms of how do you dive into that moment once you know that moment is there? Or because there's
what moment?
Well, that you're actually leaving this body and that the soul transmigrates, or you know, that the jiva transmigrates, and so my question is really, what does the scripture say in terms of how do you use that moment in the most conscious way?
The moment of the transmigration.
Yeah. Is there anything said about that?
Oh, I think there are some things said about it. And there's just traditionally how people are around it. Like when a person is dying, they will be having chants and they'll be chanting into the ear of the dying person. You know, like Narayana, Narayana, Narayana. Trying to influence the mind to think of Bhagawan instead of think of, I wish I was still at the store and or whatever, you know. So they're trying to prepare the mind for death, and singing different bhajans all around the name of the Lord and values and all of that to try to incite all of that in the soul, in the jiva that's going to transmigrate, so that it will attract to itself better karmas. That's what they're trying to do. Whether that's realistic or not, Swamiji doesn't. Sometimes he'll say, you know, at the time of death, you're kind of, there is no more will or anything as you're leaving the body. When that transition is taking place, you just are what you are. You know, so we're trying to give some support through chanting and love and prayers and. That's why also they're all often named, but you know, Narayana and Shiva, and that's your own name. So they're saying Shiva, 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 Shiva. Make you think of the Lord to influence your travels. You know. But so you might yourself be trying to prepare in that way. I know the Tibetans have a lot of preparation they do.
Mm.
We don't think of it so much in that way, except what I'm saying is kind of a natural preparation to go in a positive direction instead of to go toward punya and go toward dharma, go toward Ishwara instead of toward, you know, darker, baser things, if you know to do that.
Mm.
And even whether there is reincarnation and all of that, you know, the transmigration, that's all shraddha. In the Shastra, even though there's so much anecdotal evidence and there's so much logic that can support that Shastric position, you know, in our experience, there's a lot of logic to kind of support that and
the transmigration idea.
But you can't get to it yourself to really prove that.
But
if the Shastra says that, that becomes what we call a pratigna. Pratigna is an initial statement of a syllogism. And if the Shastra gives some initial statement, then your logic can substantiate the initial statement, but you can't get that initial statement yourself.
So Swamiji once said something like,
anonymity is it's absolutely taken for granted.
I think it was more
also.
Than that.
To me, it's a fact also, though, and I'm not saying I've had any super experiences, but it's, I just can't see how it could be otherwise in my own. Everything fits into a logically when I accept that, and if I don't, nothing makes sense to me. It doesn't work.
The situation when you die is you go into the causal state?
When you die?
Yeah.
I think that from what I've heard, so I don't know about this really, this is just things that I've heard, that when you die, you may go into a causal state, like a deep sleep state. It could be for some time until your karmas are ready to match the environment.
To manifest,
yeah.
In a new body.
In even experiencing subtle realms.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so, but on the other hand, the karmas that are drawn to you,
mm-hmm.
there could be just the perfect situation right now immediately. So you
mm-hmm.
need not go into a causal state
oh.
first and then come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can be awake and go.
Go right into a Swarga Loka or something.
Or one, another Loka.
Hopefully Swarga Loka.
Or travel. Do whatever travels and experience
right.
the different dimensions.
Okay.
Or if that's nothing's available.
Oh, so you don't have to go into the causal state at the moment.
Not as I understand it, but I remember having a conversation with Swamiji about that, and it's not
okay.
like we've had classes about it and
okay.
really discussed.
That's not really spelled out in the Shastra.
Not
in
the
detail.
It probably is somewhere in the Shastra, in the first part of the Vedas, it probably is.
What's
but not in the Vedanta.
What's the Kama Kanyo saying about that?
That's what I don't know. They probably do have a lot of detail.
Yeah.
I'm just saying what Swamiji's mentioned here and there
so
I picked up on.
So Swamiji doesn't think that moment requires any kind of preparation, or it's just a matter of being with all the knowledge that you have in that moment.
He feels your whole life is the preparation for that
yeah.
moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's no circumventing it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's who you are.
Right.
You know?
That makes sense.
Your value system is your value system. You know? You can say if some people think this is a good way to be, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Your value system is your value system. It's what you believe. It's, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What you hold to be true and what you hold to be good and all that, that maybe you're all screwy, you know? But that is yours.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what's going to be there, what you really value. Not what people have told you to value or what people have said you should be like this, but you're not like that. You're like this. And that's who you're going to be, because that's who you are in terms of your upadhi, you know?
But if your whole life is very much... If you're a mukshu, then the likelihood is you'll find that situation.
You know what they say is once you've crossed over, once you're an mukshu,
mm-hmm.
you're no longer in the same realm at all. You're not a samsari anymore. If you're really in a mukshu, you can't fake that either. You're a mukshu, you're not. If you're a mukshu, you will be a mukshu until you gain knowledge. And so the next birth you take, if you are unable to fulfill that, this, it will only be about resolving that issue. You can't go back into, a mumukshu can't go back into samsara, it's too late. Yeah, it's way too late, because it's already happened. The realization is already there that I cannot achieve what I'm looking for within duality, it's not possible. The universe simply can't do it. It's not even, there's no blame involved. It's just, you're not able to do it. It can give me lots of pleasures and things like that, you know. And I can have lots and lots of accomplishments and all of that, but I can't get what I'm fundamentally seeking.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't unknow that once you know it.
Mm-hmm.
So everything, all of your next births are only in support of finishing the job.
Mm-hmm.
Really.
Mm-hmm.
Krishna says that in the Bhagavad Gita when Arjuna is so worried about that, what's going to happen here, I'm in this war, I could be killed. I'm clear right now, but under the pressure, I understand you, but under the pressure of the war and everything, you know, I could lose it and be killed. What's going to happen to me? And he said, you will never be left, and it's called an Ubhaya Brashta. in between. You'll never be left in an in between state. You'll be born either in the house of jnanis to gain knowledge right away, pick up the thread and gain knowledge, or you'll be born in the house of dharmanishtas, because there's something in your karma that still needs to be fulfilled, and then be reunited with your knowledge a little bit later on in life, maybe when you're a teenager, 20, or whatever, 30. But you'll never be left hanging. Because those kind of karmas aren't there anymore. The only karmas that are there are, you know, taking care of resolving this. Even if you look now as, for all of us, you know, it's everything's about nishta. You gain knowledge, it's only about nishta. It's only about, my mind wasn't very kind at this time. I want to improve that, you know, or I don't, this reaction was there, that's not quite right. I would like to work on that. And not, or you're behaving in a way where you're not owning up your knowledge, so you're working on that. Everything's either you're with your knowledge or you're with your sadhana. There's nothing else. You know, all these other things you do, lots of other things, we have our jobs and all these other things that we do, but that's not what we're really doing. Mm-hmm. We're doing all those things, but we're doing all those things for something else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the priority.
Yeah, the priority is that gaining that jnana-nishtha, letting that flower unfold completely. The flower of my knowledge. Nothing else. We do so many other things. It's not that we don't. We do so many other things, but all those other things, you know, are means for gaining this. You know, we work and make money and do everything we need to do. Lots of things.
It's actually a relief, you know, to realize that the things one does in the world really don't matter so much. I mean, you could practically do anything. It's just what it is, kind of.
It's just your power of the karma.
Yeah, right.
And here you are, and you're doing your best.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Swamiji. It's so simple. I keep growing into the simplicity of Swamiji. You know, like when he says, you know, I do what's in front of me to be done to the best of my ability every day. That's what I do. And that's it. It was that final, and that's it. That's all. That's all it is. Because there's no raga dvesha, it's just Ishvara, you know. And I have my duties to do. It's part of the karma, the reason I'm here. We all have our duties, you know. We all have some usefulness, that's something that we're meant to do. Every moment, this is my task. So he just does his tasks as best as he can, as they present themselves. And he doesn't worry about the future. This was several years ago at Sailorsburg. I remember when I was there as the manager. When we started, there wasn't very much money, and so we only had enough money for 2 or 3 days, sometimes one day. Swamiji never worried about it. He didn't worry about it at all, not at all, never. But some of the people, some of the guys that were doing the construction, and were spending a lot of money on the construction. How can we even plan if there's no money? Yeah. We can't even plan this. There's not enough money to even make the plan. And they had their own perspective, you know, but they felt really worried, and how could they spend money that wasn't there? And Swamiji would just say, just do it. Do it. It'll be fine. The money will come. Don't worry. You just do it. You do good work. You know? But the guys and some of the board members were getting really worried about it and everything. He said, okay, I'll just, if it falls, if it collapses, it falls and it collapses, and I'll go to Rishikesh. Fine. You know, And he said, we're doing good work here. We're doing a good work. If Bhagavan doesn't want it, then we'll go.
What happened?
He said, if Bhagavan doesn't want this, then we'll go. And he said it kind of gruffly.
Mm.
And then he went up to his room. Just got up and walked right up to his room. And everybody was like, no, it's okay, we don't want it. That was really intense.
Sadhguru to say that it's meant to happen. It doesn't matter how hard you try for it, no, not to happen, it's going to happen. If it's not meant to happen, it doesn't matter how hard you try to make it happen.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. That's also kind of relaxing. Just you don't have to worry. And it doesn't make you lazy. It shouldn't make you into a lazy person. It makes you be conscious, present to your life, and to do things, to do what's here to be done now. And that's so simple, but it works so well. Because otherwise we're living in our imaginary world of what we're worried about is going to happen. That's where we live. Instead of living here with what is actually happening and what is actually here to be done right now. You know, so the more we come, bring our mind to living in the present, the better it gets. The simpler it is, the more shanti our mind has, the more we're able to be with each other, you know, in the present while we're actually here. It's often we're not here, you know. We're in the future or in the past.
Now this idea that the mind tends to generate that one needs to be of service, you know, that one needs to kind of commit to generating more punya in one's life. All of these ideas seem like they're all still kind of stuck in some kind of, maybe for lack of better words, material spiritual.
They're stuck in samsara.
Spiritual materialism. You know, it's a certain kind of like, okay, if I'm really doing more service, then I'm a better person, and then I can psychologically feel more at peace, and then I'm also getting more punya for the next life. It seems also sticky. You know what I mean?
The punya papa, I'm doing this so that I can get more punya, that's samsara.
Yeah.
But for a jnani, what it is, everything I do is for antakarana shuddhi.
Mm-hmm.
If it's for anything, it's for antakarana shuddhi.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not even for antakarana shuddhi, it's just for Bhagavan. Because this is what's here to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's for punya, that punya is so I can get a better birth.
Mm-hmm.
A better birth next time. So we wouldn't say we're doing these for punya, we're doing it for antakarana shuddhi.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're doing it because it's here to be done.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it amounts to in the end.
But if you say we're doing it for Bhagavan,
that
Bhagavan doesn't need
Bhagavan. He doesn't need us to do it.
Yeah.
It's a way of saying it's my karupta.
Uh-huh.
That's all it means.
Okay.
This is my karupta.
And really it's just Ishwar's plan of what's happening.
Yeah, it's my karupta. This is it. So it's my karupta, so I do it. But we say that Ishwar, Arpan, Buddhi, everything is a worship of Ishwar because everything is Ishwar. So that brings in some bhakti, some nice feelings about it.
What did
but
you just call
them? Ishwar, Arpan, Buddhi.
Arpana?
Arpana. Arpana.
Arpana.
Arpana is worship.
Okay.
Yeah, like a puja. Everything I do is like a puja to
Ishwar, Arpana, Buddhi.
Arpana. Ishwar, Arpana, Buddhi.
Mm.
I see something's happening on the table.
Arpana is the same word as in Brahmarpanam.
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 Yeah. Mm. Oh. You can see by Swamiji the list of how to live. and then it's sort of seen in our life too, just the way it appears, but it'd be just, I feel just,
yeah,
just
yeah.
Right.
Swallowji didn't have time to do anything but Ishwara. His whole life was only teaching, you know, from morning till night. Teaching and doing, running the ashram, answering the life, but it was all. Yeah, he had time to come out. Not that he would ever be able to come out of it. That's all he did. There was no time for him. There was no self there. There's no room for jiva. Yeah, because he was always totally engaged with from early morning till late at night. Though he would get some soccer squeezed in.
And cricket.
And cricket, yeah.
Can I ask you a question? It's a different subject, though.
Okay. Are you ready?
Earlier you were talking about how the self doesn't have any it doesn't have size.
Yeah.
You're comparing it to space. But unlike space, it's not
space. Space has dimension, right?
Dimension,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I've heard you speak about it before, but somehow it made a lot of sense to me this time.
Yeah.
So I guess could you say more about, well, if the self doesn't have dimension, but it's always, it pervades, everything is in the self.
Oh, I see what you're going, yeah.
Then what is the dimension?
Yeah.
How can that be?
The thing, yeah, that's right. The thing is, the imagination or the creation, this manifestation, wherever that is, the self is, because there's nothing but the self. There's nothing but the self. So say you get rid of the creation for the moment, then there's just one non-dual conscious being that is infinite because there is nothing else. So you can't, because there's nothing else, you can't say that it's big or small or goes everywhere, because there is no everywhere. There's only me. And there's nothing but that. So you can't say that it's big or small or tall, or these words don't apply because there is nothing else. It's absolutely non-dual. It has no parts. There's no second thing to give it a border. You know, like say, well, it's infinite. I mean, it's huge. Say it's huge. But when that hugeness comes to an end, then there's something else outside of it. So there's nothing else. So none of these words, dimensional words, work. Now, as kind of what Swamiji is calling an incidental attribute of the self is Maya. Incidental attribute means it's there, but it brings about no change to the self at all. Right? That's what we call it, mitya. It has no independent being at all. But what does that Maya look like? It looks like the infinite manifestation of the universe. That's something that we can't really even imagine what it looks like. That would be really interesting. Like, what is your imagination? If you were to be able to imagine this infinite display, what would it really look like if you were able to look at it from a distance or something? But that infinite, we get to experience it close up, you know. This is all Ishwara. We get to experience it. But what would it look like as an infinite manifestation? We don't really know. You know? But that infinite manifestation is the manifestation of Brahman. It just has no being apart from Brahman. It can't change Brahman in any way, but this is its manifestation. And then, you know, when you, we get to experience, it's not that we don't get to experience it, because we can look up the stars, we can take walks through nature in terms of that which is not just man-made, you know, but which is the actual creation that we've built upon as jivas, you know. The beauty of it and the amazing beauty of it, even of having living, the beauty of the living beings. It's just incredible what it is. And then think of it, think of the incredible nature, and then think of that, what that must be like in terms of the whole infinite manifestation. You know? And that's, that is the natural expression of Brahman, of me. It is actually the expression of me. Like he's using this bottom shelf as a pillow.
She's foundational. So what's the incidental attribute?
Can it's a term that, that Swamiji has used. If you say something is incidental, it means that it's not necessary, it doesn't bring about any change to Brahman. If you say something's an attribute of a substance, then it's a quality. So you have to say it's an incidental attribute, because it doesn't belong to anybody else, but it also doesn't bring about any change to Brahman. So that's just some English language he learned.
So that means everything is an incidental attribute.
Everything, yeah. There, everything is an incidental attribute. The whole Maya Upadi, the whole Maya is Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
Has Brahman for its reality. And comes from Brahman, sustained by Brahman, resolves into Brahman.
Swamiji is the expression as though.
As though. It's an as though attribute. Then you have to define as though. It means it doesn't bring about anything. It's called Vivarta Upadana Karana. The Upadana, Karana means cause. Upadana Karana means material cause, like the pot, the clay is the material cause of the pot. Vivarta Upadana Karana means the material cause is Vivarta. It doesn't go through any modification to become the effect. So Brahman is the material cause of the creation, but nothing has happened to it to become the material cause of the creation. It hasn't gone through any type of modification. So you can think of it, well, how could that be? Well, just like you are the material cause of your imagination. You are the sat-chit of your imagination. Without that, what we call the adhishtana. Adhishtana goes with mithya. The imagination is mithya. It's an incidental attribute of me. I'm what is actually there, the adhishtana. I'm the consciousness and the being which that imagination or that daydream or that dream enjoys. Right? So I'm what is actually there, therefore I'm the upadana karana, I'm the material cause. But I haven't gone through any type of modification to become that. It's not like if you have an imagination, nothing happens to you to become that imagination. You know, and when the imagination goes away, nothing's happened. Either way, nothing's happened. It comes from you, sustained by you, goes back into you. You just remain exactly the same. So that's the nature of Brahman, or of me. Me. The me never changes. The whole universe comes from me, sustained by me, resolves into me. Me, the self, which is the self in all beings. This me, this very personal self, is actually your very personal self. So you think you're you and I'm me, but no. We're all only me, sorry. All of you are just me. It's me.
But aren't we both? Isn't that a kind of rather the small me experience is appearing within the large me experience? It's just a kind of a little bubble in the big bubble?
No. There's no small me. There's only one me.
Yeah. Well, I'm just kind of, I don't want to get... You know, I don't want to get stuck
in the words,
but I'm just interested in the concept. I mean, in the vision of it. You know, because there is a, you know, if we just say there's only me, that's totally true, but there's still a carol and a house and a Sasha and a blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So that needs also a certain validation. That's what I mean. How do you, you know, instead of bypassing that, how do you validate that within the vision of Vedanta? You know, that's what
you
I'm
recognize
saying.
That this yourself is myself, and that you and Sasha, the you know her intimately because you know yourself. You know who she is, but you also both have different minds,
mm-hmm.
and different bodies, different histories, different experiences.
Yeah.
Right? So you recognize those differences, and you recognize that the core is this one conscious being, so you know her intimately. You couldn't know her any better, because who is there? Because
mm-hmm.
who is there is your very being, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then the differences comes in the upadis.
Mm-hmm.
And look, there's an infinite display of difference. But they all the infinite display of difference, all enjoys one self. Let's do our prayer so we can have some ice cream. Because I see it over there, it's going to melt. I want to eat it. Swasti prajabhyak paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmane vyashivamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshati parjanyah prativi sasya shalini desho yamksho parahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschid dukha bhag bhavet Asato ma sukhamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om